third case of the day, Trinitu Dew versus Cole. Mr. Stegall?
Yes. Well, thank you. On the substantive law, fortunately, I've never been in the nightmare I just heard at a magistrate's settlement. It can happen, I'm sure. This is a case arising out of sexual abuse of a teacher on a student at Pekin High School. It was filed after, it's 2003, or the date she turned, it was filed when she, after she reached, within the time after she reached the age of majority.
So, Mr. Stegall, I have a procedural question for you. I think I know the answer, but I just want to clarify. Mr. Redman, or Major Redman, whatever we should call him, filed a motion to dismiss, and there's an order that appears at tab 3 of your brief from Judge Mim granting that motion. Now, this looks to me like a 12B6 motion.
Yes, it was.
Okay. So, in other words, Mr. Redman is out of the case on 12B6, and
yes,
there's never any development of a summary judgment record with respect to him.
Well, it's a little more complicated because after we do the discovery, the witnesses here are straightforward. I move to amend based on the rulings of this, which the Supreme Court now has ended on the preemption of Section 1983 claims. In fact, I had the case that accepts out that said the harasser, an action against the harasser, Delgado versus Stegall, I might add, a name that's not me, not covered.
Yes, right.
Yeah, is not preempted. Well, I said, let's try the bystander theory after we did discovery, because we had taken Redmond's deposition before the 12B6 dismissal. So that was before Judge Mim on summary judgment and the evidence of what Redmond said. So while the supervisory claim wasn't, the bystander claim was. And as my friend agrees, the evidence, his deposition's been taken, all the evidence is here in the record.
So there's actually no, now that the Supreme Court has made its ruling on the relation between Title IX and Section 1983, one could have thought, well, if you had been dismissed at a 12B6 stage, perhaps there's evidence that would have been developed, because the standards are somewhat different for a Title IX case with the strong actual knowledge requirement than they are with 1983, even though you've got your complexities with 1983 and supervisory liability. But we have a line of cases that are somewhat analogous, where if a court sub silentio converts a motion from a 12B6 over to a summary judgment and one party hasn't had enough time to put together the summary judgment record, then that's cause for reversal.
Sure.
And we send it back. But you're telling me that they're really, given the way this case developed, that there actually is no additional discovery that you would undertake.
Fortunately, this could be a procedural morass, as you've noticed. My good friend agrees, as we talked, one floor above me, there's no more evidence out there.
Okay.
I mean, Redmond testified, everybody in the school district testified, the stepfather testified, that's it. So,
Even then on the 1983 claim, this case is going to rise or fall based on the statement that Major Redman made to her stepfather, really. Maybe this incident in the hall, which actually I don't find too helpful, but that's what you have.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
That's it. And you see the issue. Judge Mim, with great respect, he's been there since I was a young lawyer and now taking senior status since 1982, but as my criticism, as you saw in the brief, is he talks about all the questions about what my client thought and refers to it in a summary judgment order, or my client's stepfather, rather what the man actually said.
But what he said was really vague.
This
incident has happened before, and it just in time goes away. I don't quite know what that means.
Well, that's where we come down to, yes, but how often do you get a direct admission? Incident happened before. That certainly is a basis for inferring that he had knowledge.
This incident
Well, this, he'd just been reported abuse of a student by a teacher.
But when I made the statement about the misconduct that Cole had done to Rita, he said, well, this incident has happened before, and it just in time goes away. He can't mean Rita, because...
No, he probably doesn't. I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well,
did the deposition
of Colonel Redmond go any further, Mr. Stegall?
I got my admission, Your Honor. Judge Mim faulted me, but I'm an advocate. I said I got what I'm going to get. I'm not asking any more. Let Mr. O'Donnell clear it up. That's as good as I'm going to get. And, I mean, what I say is juries resolve these questions, is this incident has happened before. Now, what do we interpret of that? Well, I cited an additional authority that, which you all know, but it's nice to have a case saying it, that, you know, when the demeanor of a witness matters, I mean, we got to look at these people and see what Huebner says and what Redmond says. I am sometimes amazed at some contrast on summary judgment evidence that comes in criminal cases, and then we look at summary judgment, and you look over in a criminal case with a greater burden of proof. Oh, that comes in, and the jury decides it, and then we get in a civil case where, I mean, these are things that, as a matter, I would like a stronger admission, but in the real world, you're not going to get one if somebody does know something.
Well, we wouldn't learn more about whatever the history is suggested and happened before?
Well, the spin is going to be, and he did it in an affidavit, is, well, there were these things before Cole was there. But I don't, you know, that's the way out, and that's where I come back to what juries are. If they believe it, it's judgment for the defendant, but that decision,
well,
I submit to you, should be...
In order to find for you, they'd have to speculate on the meaning of that statement, because there isn't anything to explain it other than his affidavit testimony, which presumably if this case were tried, he would repeat at trial, which is that I wasn't referring to anything having to do with Cole. I was referring to my predecessor, who was dismissed for conduct of this nature. And so your whole case relies on an invitation to the jury to speculate about the meaning of that statement, and that's not good enough to create a material issue of fact.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, speculation already begs the question. That's what courts say when they say there's not enough there. I mean, we're always speculating as to what people meant and what they intended. I mean, that's why eight people decided 6 to 8 is the way juries are down there rather than judges. And I submit to you they're a better position to make that.
No, counsel. We instruct juries to decide cases based on the evidence and specifically instruct them not to rely on speculation.
Well, we rely, but they also rely on their common experiences. What I suggest to you, Your Honor, is speculation is a label we use to say, well, this isn't enough. That begs the question.
The question is
who makes this decision?
Your problem is, I mean, if you had followed up and said, well, what do you mean by this incident? What do you mean, you know, it goes away? And somehow flesh that out. You're faced with an argument that, rightly or wrongly, doesn't get people very far. If he explains it means these other incidents and doesn't confess that he's been aware of problems with coal, then... you're just going to be asking somebody to believe that he's lying. And that's usually not enough to overcome summary judgment. You know, I look at this and say, if this is the only thing that was there at trial, should a Rule 50 motion be granted? It's more or less the same standard. And I understand all of your arguments about we should give everything to juries, but that's not the way the law has developed.
Well, you've read it, so you've made your decision on that. But that's one of the problems I have with going on is looking back what they were intended is. They were supposed to make these decisions. And sure, there has to be some threshold. Should I have asked another question? But I have to tell you, we've got a savvy witness, and he makes as much of a mission I'm going to get. I'm going to take it and shut up because he'll have plenty of time to spin it later. And it took, in this case, actually, it took an affidavit later after he talked with his counsel to explain it. Because I wasn't getting into that when I had it because that's what I'm going to get and that's it.
Did you ever explore any theory that it just meant that he didn't really think that this type of inappropriate sexual behavior was a big problem, that it was kind of a boys will be boys sort of thing, or it was some trivial issue?
No, again, and maybe you're going to fault me on that, I got what I was going to get as a lawyer. I knew that was about all I was going to get from the admission, and I'm not giving him a way out from that. And if that's not enough, well, you know...
How could he get out? If your interpretation, Mr. Siegel, of this incident that happened before is a good admission, or as good as you say it's going to get, how could he have spun out of that by saying anything that would have weakened your case? That
Judge Flom, I like to keep things simple.
or maybe ambiguous.
Well, possibly yes, but I'm a minimalist because as an experienced trial lawyer, I think you do you more your damage with what you ask following things than ever. I've seen people destroy themselves by keeping their mouths working. I would like to turn to the Title IX because I can tell you quickly before my rebuttal took the time I want to save a little is there's two issues in this case I think are very important. No doubt they didn't have notice beforehand if Redmond isn't a decision maker. I submit to you that this is not your run-of-mill case. That's why my friend Ralph Davis got me, because the federal aspects of the Army funds this, and actually Redmond's making the decision on the funds for the ROTC decision insofar as Pekin's concerned. So he may well be the decision maker. Judge Mims says no. The other two things, though, one is she clearly did not give her the opportunity to return to the ROTC class. Now, they may have been well-intentioned in thinking she didn't want it, but that's what Title IX's about. They were well-intentioned when they didn't have women in sports, too. But, you know, if you deny it, they clearly denied that with actual knowledge of her report of the sexual.
Is there any evidence that she specifically said, I'd like to be put back in the ROTC class?
Her testimony was that they did not want her to go back and they put her in an English class.
But she never, is there any testimony of either she or her parents on her behalf asking that she be put back in?
That's what she said. I got it in my brief. Again, that's what she said. That's another problem on summary judgment. We try and build these things, and when you get to write them, they become a lot bigger than you thought during these times. Another reason for that, although I got to say with Redmond, that didn't occur. But the other one is the on-student harassment. The police were called, and I submit to you that they certainly knew about it afterwards, this on-student harassment of her. There's evidence in her of her mother and her continued on into the next year. They knew about it, and they certainly had an obligation to take effect. Whether it's severe enough, how do you ever prove how it affects over time other than the way we've done it here? Thank you for your time. It's an interesting argument.
Okay, Mr. O'Donnell?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Phil O'Donnell for Pekin High and for Lee Redmond, who are the two parties, appellees to this appeal. I think it's clear from the record that Mr. Cole did not participate in this case. I think some of the pleadings that were filed on the appellant side may have labeled Cole as an appellant. He's not. I'm not going to discuss Sergeant Cole unless the court has specific questions about the procedural history. I would agree with the counsel, with Mr. Stiegel, that we both feel that we have all the facts that are going to be developed in this case. It's clear to me the court has a very straightforward understanding of what those facts are. I think our briefs speak for themselves. This court, a year ago, in a case called Springer versus Durflinger that Judge Flom was on the panel for, entertained another case from downstate that came across, came this way from our district court in Peoria, and it was a case where the plaintiffs had sued saying they were retaliated against by their high school administrators of Morton High School because of problems with the softball coaches, coach for their daughter. That case, Durflinger, cited in my brief and relied upon by Judge Mim, simply states that we cannot proceed forward to trial in a case where the plaintiff's theory of the case rests upon and relies upon pure conjecture and speculation. And we know what Mr. Huebner thought, but I would submit to the court, as Judge Mim concluded, that that's not sufficient to deliver this case to the jury for 3 or 4 days, given what all the other facts are.
You may be right, Mr. O'Donnell. It's a little troubling to see somebody in the position of authority that Major, whatever his rank is now, Redmond has, allegedly saying, we have to assume at this stage of the proceedings that this is what he said, well, this incident, by which I understand at least misconduct like Cole's, if not this exact thing, this incident's happened before and it just in time goes away. That's a rather cavalier attitude that suggests maybe he wasn't supervising adequately. Maybe he was turning the blind eye. Because the standards of liability under 1983 are, of course, different from the standards in Title IX.
I agree, Judge, but that statement alone, I don't think under the bystander liability standard, separate standard in a certain sense from a Monell custom and practice issue, I don't think there's any evidence of a Monell custom and practice here by the school.
No, I don't think so
either. And I don't mean to infer that your question suggested that, but on the bystander liability standard, as the Hildebrandt case cited by counsel in his appellant's brief, there has to be evidence that Mr. Redmond condoned, ratified, or participated or acquiesced in this conduct, and there just is not that evidence. Mr. Cole was in this program from 1996 until the date of his termination on the date of the report of November 5th, 2003. Major Redmond came into the program about a year later. This is a big school. This is, I think, one of the two biggest high schools downstate Illinois. So leave the Chicago area out of the question here. There's about 2,800 students at our school, and it's clear from Superintendent Davis's deposition that counsel took that from time to time we do have teachers that, for lack of a better term, go astray and do something that's inappropriate. I think that her testimony on those issues as to other teachers for the purposes of a trial would be irrelevant, but for the purposes of illustrating to this court the fact that we know from what we read in the papers these days that things go wrong in schools, and the Supreme Court in Davis 10 years ago made clear that the schools and the districts, the taxpayers, should not be the insurers of the victim's claims to the extent that there is not actual knowledge and then deliberate indifference and a response that's clearly unreasonable after the actual knowledge or such facts that are sufficient to indicate actual knowledge exist.
Right, and I understand Mr. Siegel to be saying, putting Redmond's position to one side and putting also to one side whatever goes forward with the alleged peer harassment, it's difficult to imagine, at least for me, I'm speaking for myself now, difficult to imagine a more prompt and effective response than the authorities at this school took. I mean, the mother goes with her, seems to me like an hour later, they're at the police office and this man's employment's terminated. So I don't think anybody is questioning that as soon as they get actual knowledge, they move promptly. The question is, where does Redmond fit into this picture on the one hand, and what happens at the back end on the other hand?
I think what he said in his deposition, what he said in his deposition was, I think it was actually in his grand jury testimony, he was subpoenaed into the grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
After litigation ensued, we procured the transcript because we wanted to find out about these other girls. Our administrators had no knowledge of these other girls until they read stuff in the paper that had been leaked to the grand jury in early 2004 about other students coming forward to complain. That proceeding apparently was somewhat porous, and unfortunately, our school got a lot of bad press because of the two students, former students actually, who came forward after the fact. As respects Major Redmond, I guess what I will say, Your Honor, is that he did say under oath in the grand jury that if someone would have told me this was going on, I would have told someone, I would have done something. I think it's more or less those terms. As respects his testimony, though, and one of the things you were inquiring of Mr. Siegel is this deposition. We did the deposition of Major Redmond, who's now an employee of the Army itself, full-time down Louisville, Kentucky, back in, I think, 2007. 12B6 motion was not ruled upon. That was one of the reasons we went forward and got the deposition done. But this question about this issue, about this statement Huebner says exists, was never discussed in that deposition. In fact, several months later we did Huebner's deposition, and then we learn of that statement. I don't suppose necessarily that Mr. Siegel had forgotten about the statement. I just don't know if Mr. Siegel even knew about the statement. But it was not a subject of discussion in Redmond's deposition testimony taken before the 12B6 motion was ruled upon by Judge Mim. We did, of course, have the grand jury testimony from Tazewell County Circuit Court, at which Major Redmond testified at length. The other two victims did testify at length as well. But I don't think we can bootstrap in here when it's not disputed that these two other victims did not come forward until they read about Ms. Trenadue's report. I don't think we can bootstrap that into an issue of fact under the applicable standards as they are under the court's opinion, for example, as I mentioned, the Durflinger opinion, and all the Title IX opinions that are there. Even looking at the Section 1983 standard, cases say these standards are different. The language that's used are, of course, different in a Title IX than a Title or than a Section 1983 case. But for practical purposes, in this case, I'm certain that the outcome is the same, and that is there deliberate indifference by our district? I don't think that this statement, taken in a vacuum of Mr. Redmond, is sufficiently indicative of deliberate indifference by Major Redmond as a state actor or by Major Redmond as a supervisor. It does not illustrate a policy, a practice, or a procedure of deference or of ignorance or of ratification that might support
Mr. O'Donnell, the grand jury testimony that you speak of, it has no language that would identify with this statement that allegedly was made about this incident has happened before.
That's true, Your Honor. And Kirk Schoenbein, who's a esteemed prosecutor downstate, now at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Peoria, conducted that grand jury, and I think that, quite frankly, I don't think Mr. Schoenbein was aware of this alleged statement. This alleged statement came up for the first time close to 6-7 months after we did Mr. Redmond's deposition in Louisville, Kentucky, when I took the deposition from Mr. Huebner. Mr. Huebner, by his own statement, said he was very animated and was looking to implicitly take things into his own hands when he went that morning.
What's Mr. Major Redmond's tenure at the ROTC program?
Not to get into too complicated specifics of how the ROTC program works, I would agree Mr. Stiegel has succinctly summarized Redmond's testimony on it. A year and a half after these incidents transpired, Mr. Redmond was offered a supervisory role, supervisory employment with the Department of the Army as a civilian employee. That's where he still is today, supervises ROTC programs all around the country.
Yeah, no, I mean, I want to focus, if we could for a moment, on his time, whatever that is, at Pekin High.
About 7 years, Your Honor. And he was arriving in the fall semester of 1997. Mr. Cole had arrived about a year or so earlier.
But he's Mr. Cole. As soon as he arrives, he's Mr. Cole's superior.
Yes. By rank, of course.
Redmond runs the program, does he not, the ROTC program?
Subject to any control of the Department of the Army and Pekin High staff.
I understand, but are we to view the ROTC program as not under the administration's supervision, the school's administrator's supervision?
No, Your Honor. These two individuals, Mr. Cole and Mr. Redmond, are both employees of the school on the school's payroll. They're school employees. The funding mechanism is that half of their salary and all the benefits come from the Army.
All right. So
They're in what's called vocational department. This high school has a big vocational department, of which ROTC is a very small program, very small portion. The supervisor at the time of that program was a man by the name of Murray Bryant. Shop, all kinds of mechanical type of classes are offered. This is a small elective program at Pekin High.
Yeah, so that's why this is a 1983 case and not a Federal Tort Claims Act case?
I didn't file the case, Your Honor. And I have pondered that about 3.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I wondered when I was reading the brief.
But what I will say is we know what all the cases from this court said of Bulhanis and Wade and all those cases, the Doe case. And then this year we were surprised to get the Supreme Court's opinion. As respects Section 1983, I will certainly acknowledge to the court that the discovery might have been a little different, the depositions might have been conducted a little bit differently, but the facts are facts. Mr. Redmond is a supervisor from the standpoint of he was superior to this malefactor to the tortfeasor. And I think under the Delgado case, that my esteemed opponent, who knows more Section 1983 law than I could ever hope to digest, he can, if he acts with ignorance and acquiesces or ratifies that conduct under Section 1983, he could have individual liability. I don't think there's a dispute about that given the holding in Fitzgerald. It's my contention and it's our belief, and I think Judge Mim was right, that here, if we look at everything we have to look at, there just isn't evidence of any implied Monell issue or a bystander type of cause of action, which I will submit to the court, bystander claims.
What if this statement was made by the head of the English department? And these incidents occurred, let's say, during a theater event. I'm just trying to frame this, and I want, so you understand where I'm going. I want to understand why we shouldn't look at Redden in, as the head of this activity, sanctioned, funded, or whatever by Pekin. Pekin High feels it's appropriate to have this function, it's further its educational program. Why Redmond's operation, if you will, or supervision of that small unit, it should be viewed any differently than any department head in the high school?
You're probably right. I mean, quite frankly, if you say this, if you just take this bland statement in a vacuum, mm-hmm. you can say that this bland statement in, taken in a vacuum attributed to, let's say, the department head in another department, if that's what we have, then what do we have? We have Major Sergeant Boulay, who was let go and was replaced by Major Redmond, and then we have, between about 1990, by Superintendent Davis's testimony, through approximately 2006, when she gave her deposition in a school of 2,800 students, we've had about three other teachers who we have terminated upon receipt of reports of inappropriate contacts. It's clearly my belief that just because we've had teachers go astray, who we have to terminate, that certainly that does not expose us to a valid Title IX or Section 18.
I don't mean to suggest that, but I'm wondering whether his comment is something that he's picked up anecdotally as some historian, or whether he was a participant during the periods of his tenure at the school. But you say that's all speculation, my inquiry just now.
I think you have to read it in the context of what all the facts are going to be if we hypothetically had a trial. And this man testified under oath twice. It might have been more beneficial to this court that we have direct inquiry in the deposition.
Well, I wish we had. But
it
we
may
don't.
Also be that neither myself nor Mr. Stiegel were knowledgeable about that statement until we got to Conrad Huebner's deposition. We don't always control the sequencing of these depositions.
No, but a revisiting of another deposition already had certainly could have been attended to, right? I mean, we
I guess the bluegrass state's a long way away, Your Honor, and I don't want to call into question Mr. Stiegel's motives for doing anything, but I would agree that the situation is ambiguous in the context of what the statement means as respects the absence of inquiry in the deposition.
I understand.
Thus the affidavit. That's. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have essential points I make, and I can respond to questions. I try to get them as quickly as possible. The points I want to make is the evidence was that she was not given the option, was what Trinidad testified to go back to the ROTC. That was the record. The other part on the student-student harassment, actually, they acted impeccably when they found out about this, excluding Redmond and his statement. But the two Title IX claims that I think are clear are the on-student sexual harassment and then this not giving her the option to go back.
Now, your opponent argues that you really didn't develop the on-student harassment theory in the district court.
Well, I attached my statements of fact where I put it out and said it's here, and I put it before him, and we've been many a plaintiff have been hung by not doing that, and I put the facts there, and the judge had them, so it's there.
And they also argue that even if it were there, it wasn't severe, pervasive enough, in that she seems to have actually done quite well in high school, goes on, she's National Honor Society. True, she has the counseling that you point to, and I'm not saying it was pleasant, but is it severe and pervasive enough under the law?
Well, that's the $64,000 question to quote you previously in reasonableness. How do you take, in hindsight, incidents occurring over this time in a high school with all that's going on in that turmoil of teenagers and put that? I submit that the fact the police were called, she was on ongoing counseling, she brought it up to teachers in her senior year or a year later, shows that it's severe. Her mother was concerned, too. I don't know how else we can prove that otherwise. And that's one of the things, points I would make on the summary judgment and why I went into the law review on this is that, that's the reasonableness there on an education. I submit that jurors are probably better than judges or lawyers to unravel that. I would also add a comment. You've asked why we didn't do things. Another thing that comes down to summary judgment, I have to tell you, Judge, I can't tell you recalling whether I actually knew what Hubner said and consciously chose not to or didn't. I wish I were that good. When you take these, and that's the problem for the practitioner on summary judgment is, you're going taking these witnesses, then you frame the issues. And another problem I have as a practitioner living this is you don't get as good a result because, you take it. The idea of going back to taking, if Mr. O'Donnell had agreed, I could have, but the chances of getting the magistrate judge to let me do that, Judge, are not very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Thank you, Mr. O'Donnell. Case is taken under advisement.